Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg. Chapter 5. The Consequences of Social Reformism and General Nature of Reformism. In the first chapter, we aim to show that Bernstein's theory lifted the program of the socialist movement off its material base and tried to place it on an idealist base. How does this theory fare when translated into practice? Upon the first comparison, the party practice resulting from Bernstein's theory does not seem to differ from the practice followed by the social democracy up to now. Formerly, the activity of the Social Democratic Party consisted of trade union work, of agitation for social reforms, and the democratization of existing political institutions. The difference is not in the what, but in the how. At present, the trade union struggle and parliamentary practice are considered to be the means of guiding and educating the proletariat in preparation for the task of taking over power. From the revisionist standpoint, this conquest of power is at the same time impossible or useless. And therefore, trade union and parliamentary activity are to be carried on by the party only for their immediate results, that is, for the purpose of bettering their present situation of the workers, for the gradual reduction of capitalist exploitation, for the extension of social control. So that if we do not consider momentarily the immediate amelioration of the workers' condition, an objective common to our party program as well as to revisionism, the difference between the two outlooks is, in brief, the following. According to the present conception of the party, trade union and parliamentary activity are important for the socialist movement because such activity prepares the proletariat, that is to say, creates the subjective factor of the socialist transformation for the task of realizing socialism. But, according to Bernstein, trade unions and parliamentary activity gradually reduce capitalist exploitation itself. They remove from capitalist society its capitalist character. They realize objectively the desired social change. Examining the matter closely, we see that the two conceptions are diametrically opposed. Viewing the situation from the current standpoint of our party, we say that as a result of its trade union and parliamentary struggles, the proletariat becomes convinced of the impossibility of accomplishing a fundamental social change through such activity, and arrives at the understanding that the conquest of power is unavoidable. Bernstein's theory, however, begins by declaring that this conquest is impossible. It concludes by saying that socialism can only be introduced as a result of the trade union struggle and parliamentary activity. For, as seen by Bernstein, trade union and parliamentary action has a socialist character because it exercises a progressively socializing influence on capitalist economy. We tried to show that this influence is purely imaginary. The relations between capitalist property and the capitalist state develop in entirely opposite directions, so that the daily practical activity of the present social democracy loses, in the last analysis, all connection with work for socialism. From the viewpoint of a movement for socialism, the trade union struggle and our parliamentary practice are vastly important insofar as they make socialistic the awareness, the consciousness of the proletariat, and help to organize it as a class. But once they are considered as instruments of the direct socialization of capitalist economy, they lose out not only their usual effectiveness, but also cease being means of preparing the working class for the conquest of power. Edward Bernstein and Conrad Schmidt suffer from a complete misunderstanding when they console themselves with the belief that even though the program of the party is reduced to work for social reforms and ordinary trade union work, the final objective of the labor movement is not thereby discarded. For each forward step reaches beyond the given immediate aim, and the socialist goal is implied as a tendency in the supposed advance. That is certainly true about the present procedure of the German social democracy. It is true whenever a firm and conscious effort for conquest of political power impregnates the trade union struggle and the work for social reforms. But if this effort is separated from the movement itself, and social reforms are made an end in themselves, then such activity not only does not lead to the final goal of socialism, but moves precisely in the opposite direction. Conrad Schmidt simply falls back on the idea that an apparently mechanical movement, once started, cannot stop by itself because, quote, one's appetite grows with the eating, and the working class will not supposedly content itself with reforms till the final socialist transformation is realized. Now, the last mentioned condition is quite real. Its effectiveness is guaranteed by the very insufficiency of capitalist reforms. But the conclusion drawn from it could only be true if it were possible to construct an unbroken chain of augmented reforms leading from the capitalism of today to socialism. This is, of course, sheer fantasy. In accordance with the nature of things as they are, the chain breaks quickly, and the paths that the supposed forward movement can take from the point they are on are many and varied. What will be the immediate result should our party change its general procedure to suit a viewpoint that wants to emphasize the practical results of our struggle, that is, social reforms? As soon as immediate results become the principal aim of our activity, the clear-cut, irreconcilable point of view, which has meaning only insofar as it proposes to win power, will be found more and more inconvenient. The direct consequence of this will be the adoption by the party of a policy of compensation, a policy of political trading, and an attitude of diffident diplomatic conciliation. But this attitude cannot be continued for a long time. Since the social reforms can only offer an empty promise, the logical consequence of such a program must necessarily be disillusionment. It is not true that socialism will arise automatically from the daily struggle of the working class. Socialism will be the consequence of 1. The growing contradictions of capitalist economy, and 2. Of the comprehension by the working class of the unavailability of the suppression of these contradictions through a social transformation. When, in the manner of revisionism, the first condition is denied and the second rejected, the labor movement finds itself reduced to a simple cooperative and reformist movement. We move here in a straight line toward the total abandonment of the class viewpoint. This consequence also becomes evident when we investigate the general character of revisionism. It is obvious that revisionism does not wish to concede that its standpoint is that of the capitalist apologist. It does not join the bourgeois economists in denying the existence of the contradictions of capitalism. But, on the other hand, what precisely constitutes the fundamental point of revisionism, and distinguishes it from the attitude taken by the social democracy up to now, is that it does not base its theory on the belief that the contradictions of capitalism will be suppressed as a result of the logical inner development of the present economic system. We may say that the theory of revisionism occupies an intermediate place between two extremes. Revisionism does not expect to see the contradictions of capitalism mature. It does not propose to suppress these contradictions through a revolutionary transformation. It wants to lessen, to attenuate, the capitalist contradictions, so that the antagonism existing between production and exchange is to be mollified by the cessation of crises and the formation of capitalist combines. The antagonism between capital and labor is to be adjusted by bettering the situation of the workers and by the conservation of the middle classes. And the contradiction between the class state and society is to be liquidated through increased state control and the progress of democracy. It is true that the present procedure of the social democracy does not consist in waiting for the antagonisms of capitalism to develop, and in passing on only then to the task of suppressing them. On the contrary, the essence of revolutionary procedure is to be guided by the direction of this development once it is ascertained, and inferring from this direction what consequences are necessary for the political struggle. Thus, the social democracy has combated tariff wars and militarism without waiting for their reactionary character to become fully evident. Bernstein's procedure is not guided by a consideration of the development of capitalism, by the prospect of the aggravation of its contradictions. It is guided by the prospect of the attenuation of these contradictions. He shows this when he speaks of the adaptation of capitalist economy. Now, when can such a conception be correct? If it is true that capitalism will continue to develop in the direction it takes at present, then its contradictions must necessarily become sharper and more aggravated instead of disappearing. The possibility of the attenuation of the contradictions of capitalism presupposes that the capitalist mode of production itself will stop its progress. In short, the general condition of Bernstein's theory is the cessation of capitalist development. This way, however, his theory condemns itself in a twofold manner. In the first place, it manifests its utopian character in its stand on the establishment of socialism. For it is clear that a defective capitalist development cannot lead to a socialist transformation. In the second place, Bernstein's theory reveals its reactionary character when it refers to the rapid capitalist development that is taking place at present. Given the development of real capitalism, how can we explain, or rather state, Bernstein's position? We have demonstrated in the first chapter the baselessness of the economic conditions on which Bernstein builds his analysis of existing social relationships. We have seen that neither the credit system nor cartels can be said to be means of adaptation of capitalist economy. We have seen that not even the temporary cessation of crises, nor the survival of the middle class, can be regarded as symptoms of capitalist adaptation. But even though we should fail to take into account the erroneous character of all these details of Bernstein's theory, we cannot help but be stopped short by one feature common to all of them. Bernstein's theory does not seize these manifestations of contemporary economic life as they appear in their organic relationship with the whole of capitalist development, with the complete economic mechanism of capitalism. His theory pulls these details out of their living economic context. It treats them as a disjecta membra, separate parts, of a lifeless machine. Consider, for example, his conception of the adaptive effect of credit. If we recognize credit as a higher natural stage of the process of exchange, and, therefore, of the contradictions inherent in capitalist exchange, we cannot at the same time see it as a mechanical means of adaptation existing outside of the process of exchange. It would be just as impossible to consider money, merchandise, and capital as, quote, means of adaptation of capitalism. However, credit, like money, commodities, and capital, is an organic link of capitalist economy at a certain stage of its development. Like them, it is an indispensable gear in the mechanism of capitalist economy, and at the same time, an instrument of destruction, since it aggravates the internal contradictions of capitalism. The same thing is true about cartels and the new perfected means of communication. The same mechanical view is presented by Bernstein's attempt to describe the promise of the cessation of crises as a symptom of the adaptation of capitalist economy. For him, crises are simply derangements of the economic mechanism. With their cessation, he thinks, the mechanism could function well. But the fact is that crises are not derangements in the usual sense of the word. They are derangements without which capitalist economy could not develop at all. For if crises constitute the only method possible in capitalism, and therefore the normal method, of solving periodically the conflict existing between the unlimited extension of production and the narrow limits of the world market, then crises are an organic manifestation inseparable from capitalist economy. In the unhindered advance of capitalist production lurks a threat to capitalism that is much greater than its crises. It is the threat of the constant fall of the rate of profit, resulting not only from the contradiction between production and exchange, but from the growth of the productivity of labor itself. The fall in the rate of profit has the extremely dangerous tendency of rendering impossible any enterprise for small and middle-sized capitals. It thus limits the new formation and therefore the extension of placements of capital. And it is precisely crises that constitute the other consequence of the same process. As a result of their periodic depreciation of capital, crises bring a fall in the prices of the means of production, a paralysis of a part of the active capital, and in time, the increase of profits. They thus create the possibilities of the renewed advance of production. Crises, therefore, appear to be the instruments of rekindling the fire of capitalist development. Their cessation, not temporary cessation, but their total disappearance in the world market, would not lead to the further development of capitalist economy. It would destroy capitalism. True to the mechanical view of his theory of adaptation, Bernstein forgets the necessity of crises, as well as the necessity of new placements of small and middle-sized capitals. and that is why the constant reappearance of small capital seems to him to be the sign of the cessation of capitalist development, though it is, in fact, a symptom of normal capitalist development. It is important to note that there is a viewpoint from which all the above-mentioned phenomena are seen exactly as they have been presented by the theory of adaptation. It is the viewpoint of the isolated, single, capitalist, who reflects in his mind the economic facts around him, just as they appear when refracted by the laws of competition. The isolated capitalist sees each organic part of the whole of our economy as an independent entity. He sees them as they act on him, the single capitalist. He therefore considers these facts to be simple derangements of simple means of adaptation. For the isolated capitalist, it is true, crises are really simple derangements. The cessation of crises accords him a longer existence. As far as he is concerned, credit is only a means of adapting his insufficient productive forces to the needs of the market. And it seems to him that the cartel of which he becomes a member really suppresses industrial anarchy. Revisionism is nothing else than a theoretic generalization made from the angle of the isolated capitalist. Where does this viewpoint belong theoretically, if not in vulgar bourgeois economics? All the errors of this school rest precisely on the conception that mistakes the phenomena of competition, as seen from the angle of the isolated capitalist, for the phenomena of the whole of capitalist economy. Just as Bernstein considers credit to be a means of adaptation to the needs of exchange, vulgar economy, too, tries to find the antidote against the ills of capitalism in the phenomena of capitalism. Like Bernstein, it believes that it is possible to regulate capitalist economy. And in the manner of Bernstein, it arrives in time at the desire to palliate the contradictions of capitalism, that is, at the belief in the possibility of patching up the sores of capitalism. It ends up by subscribing to a program of reaction, and it ends up in a utopia. The theory of revisionism can therefore be defined in the following way. It is a theory of standing still in the socialist movement built, with the aid of vulgar economy, on a theory of a capitalist standstill. End of chapter 5.